This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Ohio's oldest cemetery, dedicated to the burials of black people, is in need of repairs. And after some local media coverage, the community and a U.S. senator's office have stepped in to help. So we start the weekly news review with Inquirer columnist Byron McCauley. He's on the phone with us. Byron, welcome back to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you back. I'm well. Thank you for asking. And we also have with us Queen City History and Education President and CityBeat contributor Michael D. Morgan. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be on.
And Michael joins us via Zoom. So we are talking about the United American Cemetery. And Michael, I'd like you to take us back to 1844, because what's so interesting about that year and cemeteries in Cincinnati is that not only did United American Cemetery find its origins, but so did Spring Grove, which is really one of our area's most celebrated outdoor spaces where people certainly go to mourn and to be reflective, but also to really recreate. And that's not really the story for the United American Cemetery. So give our listeners the background on the United American Cemetery.
Yeah, so I was surprised to learn that both of those cemetery foundations were started in the same year, and it was not connected, but it is a really stark juxtaposition. Because you have Spring Grove evolving as this, treasure of the community, and you have United American, the state's first black burying grounds, black cemetery, really becoming neglected over the years. And so, you know, when I learned about this cemetery and I went to visit it in June, I was really taken aback to find that there were a lot of waist-high weeds and just conditions that, you know, that were not being maintained. And it has to do with an absence of resources. But it's a beautiful cemetery, and it has an incredibly rich history, both in terms of the people that, started it, as well as a lot of the people that are buried there.
And taking care of a cemetery is tough work. Byron McCauley from the Inquirer recently wrote about this as well. And the cemetery's old, Byron, but even older is the church that is charged with being the caretaker.
Yes, that is true, Michael. The church that's the caretaker, it was founded in the early 1800s.
Yeah, your article said 189 years old. It's Union Baptist Church downtown.
Yeah, Union Baptist Church, and it was explained to me that Union Baptist was one of the obviously a thriving church, and it was one of the leading churches in Cincinnati at the time when they were given the authority to take care of this cemetery, which was not really sort of an equitable bargain because the city turned it over to the church. But the church, without the means to care for it. So, as Michael pointed out, it's an issue of resources. So the church started a GoFundMe page not long ago. It started in March, and it just kind of sat there. It wasn't doing a lot. And this GoFundMe page was brought to my attention, which prompted the column earlier this week.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the response to that column, because, it was basically a call to action that you published, Byron, at the Inquirer, and you certainly got a response and some action. We're going to talk about that momentarily. And let's go back over to Michael D. Morgan. He is the Queen City History and Education President, also a contributor to CityBeat, and wrote extensively about some of the African-American cemeteries in Cincinnati, including United American. Michael, tell us, because we go back to 1844, to the origins of the foundation of this cemetery. I guess this cemetery was not in Madisonville originally.
That's correct. To date it as the oldest African-American cemetery in Ohio, you actually have to go back to Avondale. So that's where it started in 1844. And then when you hit the late 1870s, there starts to be controversy in Avondale because a lot of community leaders there, the stated reason is that we have a cemetery in the middle of what is becoming a business district, and that is not highest and best use. But you can't look back at it without seeing overt racism involved in the fact that you had this black cemetery in the heart of Avondale. So there is this push to move a cemetery, which is a pretty, you know, ludicrous thing to think about. But through a combination of pressure, as well as the board that ran the cemetery in the early 1880s, it was kind of unclear how much of it was forced versus the fact that they were able to find more land in this very kind of serene pastoral setting that they found in, you know, what is not so serene Madisonville these days. But they bought a larger plot of land, and then they had to reinter everybody that had been buried in Avondale from 1844 until 1883.
And so, Michael, when you say reinter, do you have any idea of how many people that was?
I could not find a total number of the people on how many people they had to move, but it was clearly a lot. And it seems like, and I think part of the problems in terms of a total number is that I don't know that everybody kind of received the same treatment. It was sort of a, if you had the resources to have your family member moved, you got a little more dignity in the process, I think, than if you didn't.
We're talking to Michael D. Morgan, who contributed some articles to City Beat, and Byron McCauley, a columnist at The Enquirer. Byron, let's talk a little bit about some of the people who are in this cemetery. And you note in your coverage of this situation that the oldest tombstone belonging to a black person in Cincinnati is that of Nancy Williams, who you write is described as the wife of Henry Williams and died in 1832 at age 27. What else did you find about some of the people who find their final resting spot in United American?
Oh, yeah. This was a great historic lesson for me. We had we saw where there were so many different people, just common people, but people who of means for that time. You know, you had the abolitionist John Isom Gaines, who, when he died in 1859, the Cincinnati Commercial newspaper wrote that next to Frederick Douglass, he was, you know, perhaps the most distinguished, and I quote, colored man in the United States. You had Horace Suddeth, who operated the Mance Hotel in Walnut Hills, and of course we know the Mance Hotel as being a favorite stop for travelers, African American, black travelers during that time of segregation, and also hosted a lot of stars of the time. And so, you know, that was also there. He's also buried there, in addition to, you know, some of the others that you named. You know, we had Harriet Clay, who was a seamstress, and she was a friend of Booker T. Washington. She was born in slavery, and she died in 1947. So, you know, at the age of 100, supposedly. So it was just it's just a real historic place and a place of learning, as one of the folks told me as I was reporting the story. So I feel like this could really, if we could help to spread the word, to help this cemetery and the church sort of get some funding or get more funding to kickstart this thing off, I think it would be great. And then, you know, kind of maybe even have a snowball effect with more people participating after seeing some improvement that's happening visually. That always sort of helps.
Byron, you noted Harriet Clay, a seamstress and friend of Booker T. Washington. And what struck me about that notation, that she was born into slavery and died in 1947 at age 100, is that there are still plenty of people here with us born in 1947. And it's just so incredible to think of people that we share a space with who were born in a year and existed in this country at the same time as people who were born enslaved in this nation. And so, Michael, that certainly amplifies the significance of the lives of the people that are remembered at United American. Can you talk a little bit about some of the more recent legislation related to making that space better?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had the pleasure of speaking with Senator Sherrod Brown's office about the African American Burial Act. And this was introduced in the House by a couple of Congress members, one from Virginia and one from somewhere else. But it was then picked up in the Senate by Sherrod Brown and Lamar Alexander. And what this would do is, number one, it would catalog all of these burial grounds across the United States, from cemeteries like United American and Union Baptist in Price Hill to, you know, sort of small slave burial grounds in the South. And it would catalog them, and it would provide resources to communities to on how to maintain them and kind of bring tourism into the fold as part of the economic equation, and also to just, you know, remember and respect these histories. In addition to that, it would actually open up some grant funding. So Union Baptist in Price Hill, which is the other cemetery that Union Baptist Church manages and owns, you know, it was also in really bad shape, and it was actually vandalized in 2019, and that led to some press coverage about the state of the cemetery and the vandalism of it, and that actually wound up having very positive impacts. Union Baptist wound up receiving $415,000 in total last year to improve that cemetery and, you know, kind of put it on a footing where people can respect it and appreciate it, and they plan to do tours out of it. So this kind of coverage really does, you know, help bring attention to some of these places that have been neglected and deserve better.
And Byron, I understand that you also heard from Senator Sherrod Brown's office after your coverage of the situation at United American Cemetery, but you also heard from a lot of people who don't hold high office. And your follow-up column to this includes the language, "Cincinnati is good like that. When there is a noble cause in need of support, we show up. It's part of our benevolent and collaborative nature." Tell us what happened.
Yes. So I received, more than a dozen emails and phone calls from just ordinary, everyday people acknowledging the fact that this cemetery, that they didn't know it existed, but that they wanted to help. And so I had landscape architects and people who do masonry work, and I just had people who just wanted to donate money. And so I directed several of them to the church. I directed several of them to the GoFundMe page that's still raising money. And, you know, to be sure, right now it's $11,000 that's been raised. That means it's about $10,000 within a week.
Wow.
From about 100 people.
Wow.
Which says a lot. It says a lot about the goodwill of people in this community. But it also, it shows that people really want to help move this forward. You know, it was, as Michael noted, you know, clearly, you know, to be able to uproot bodies to go to somewhere else, and the fact that, you know, the citizens back then, you know, had it declared when it was in Walnut Hills a public nuisance. So it's also sort of a modern day equity thing as well. One person who wrote but did some cost figures, put some numbers to what it might cost to renovate and restore this cemetery. And, you know, the number that this person came up with was about $1 million that would create a perpetual fund so that you wouldn't have this problem 3 years down the road. It does need a lot of work, but if you go there, and I would encourage anyone who wants to see it to do so, the topography there is just absolutely wonderful, and there's a very peaceful feeling about it when you go there to revere what is there.
And the United American Cemetery is in Madisonville. You can read more about recent events there at the Cincinnati Inquirer, courtesy of columnist Byron McCauley, and also at CityBeat, courtesy of contributor and Queen City History and Education President Michael D. Morgan. Byron, Michael, happy Friday to you both. Thanks for spending part of Friday with us. We really appreciate your insight on this.
Happy Friday. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
And some local parents are so fed up with remote education for their children, they rallied this week outside one district's offices. The weekly news review continues now with WKRC-TV Local 12 reporter and anchor Anjanette Levy. Anjanette, thank you for coming back on.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
I know we always get you on your day off, so we're extra thankful that you come on, because I know you work very early on the weekends, too. But thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to do it. Always love being on your show.
Appreciate that. So what went down in Oxford this week with some angry parents at the Talawanda School District?
Well, basically, there's a very vocal group of parents up there who don't believe the remote learning is really working for their children. They believe, you know, just to give you, to be fair, they believe the teachers are doing a wonderful job and doing their best, but they think that the children need to be back in the classroom. Specifically, I spoke with a woman who was an ICU nurse, and she said that, you know, she was caring for COVID patients several months ago, so she would stay in a separate bedroom in her home and kept her family safe that way, and no one caught COVID. And so she believes that this can be done safely if the children wear masks, if the students wear masks, the staff wear masks, teachers, that type of thing. So she feels, and the other teacher or parents feel, I should say, that the remote learning just isn't working and that the kids need to be back in the classroom.
I thought it was interesting, Anjanette, that your reporting included details that some of the parents think that the district is maintaining remote learning because of financial hardship within the district.
Right. And that was when I spoke with one of the parents by phone before going to Oxford, she had said that, and I believe they sent an email to our newsroom as well. And they had attended some meetings recently in which the district's financial position or financial situation was discussed. And they have they're going to be operating at a budget deficit and will probably need a levy, according to the superintendent. So I went into the superintendent's office to try to speak with him. He didn't want to do an on-camera interview, but he was very nice. He answered all of my questions, and I brought that up to him. And I said, look, some of these parents believe you're doing this in part to save money. And he said that's just simply not the case, that they've been projecting a budget deficit for many years, and that it's due to the funding formula from the state. He said they've applied for some CARES Act money to buy hotspots and computers and things like that, but that they've been projecting this deficit for some time. So he says that it's totally unrelated.
And we're talking to Anjanette Levy from WKRC-TV. Anjanette, a lot of us in the media have spent a lot of time talking about COVID's impact on learning at our largest school district in this region, Cincinnati Public Schools. I think we're still waiting for official word on what an in-person return might look like, but the board at Cincinnati Public did make a decision that athletics can continue. And you got the opportunity to talk to some football players in the district who are very excited, in particular, about tonight.
Right. And so I guess some of the schools are doing a scrimmage tonight, at least one of them I know, and they're very excited. They were really upset, these players, because they've been training all summer long. They say that they've been taking precautions, using certain protocols at practice to keep everybody safe so that they're not standing too closely together. Football, as you know, is a contact sport. So there are concerns that if you're piling on top of each other or getting close to each other to block somebody, that potentially you could be spreading COVID. But the players say they've been taking all of these precautions. They've been working hard. And the really sad thing about it, one of the kids that I interviewed, he said, you know, this football, getting a scholarship is, sorry about that.
No, that's okay. You're a busy journalist. I know that you've probably got sources ringing you all the time. No big deal.
This is what we do, right?
Exactly.
In the world of virtual talk shows.
Correct.
So basically, he said, you know, playing football his senior year would be his opportunity to potentially showcase his talents and catch the attention of a scout who might be able to get him a college scholarship. And he really feels like getting a scholarship would be his ticket out of where he lives right now. And, you know, we went to his home the other day to do a follow-up interview with him. He was so excited. And, you know, he's not living in the best circumstances. Just when we were there, there were people walking up and down the street screaming about I don't even know what. And so he's, I know, very excited. And so is his mother.
That's one thing I think a lot of us maybe lose sight of when we debate whether to return to athletics, obviously taking into consideration the health concerns first, but this is the opportunity for a lot of people to move on with their education. So thank you for bringing that to light for us. I want to note, Anjanette, a story that you had broken last night that involves basically a 17-year-old killing of a Kentucky wildlife officer, Doug Bryant, who died in the line of duty in 2003 during a truck chase on I-75 in Fort Mitchell. There were new details released nearly 2 decades later. What happened?
Well, basically what happened was his wife, Cheryl, she still lives over in Northern Kentucky. Her home was burglarized last November, and her home was ransacked. I mean, they went through everything. They stole some of her collectible coins that she had in her walk-in closet. And next to her walk-in closet, next to the coins, was a box. It was a wooden box, she said, that was made specially for her late husband's service weapon. And it had been presented to her and her daughter after her husband was killed during that chase on 75, as you mentioned. And she said, you know, it was really one of the final memories that they had of Doug Bryant. So the home was ransacked. She reported everything stolen. And then last weekend there was a Cincinnati Gun Crime Task Force. And they've been on patrol. They were created earlier this year in response to all of the gun violence that had been happening, especially during the pandemic. We've had a big uptick this year in gun crimes. And they were on patrol in Winton Terrace. They pulled over a guy named Ryan Bailey. And they said that Ryan Bailey said, look, I have a gun in my car for protection, and I have some marijuana. And they went through the car and they found the loaded gun and the marijuana. And they took the gun back to the station or whatever and looked at it. And it had Kentucky Department of Wildlife inscribed on it. And they determined that it was Doug Bryant's gun. So the guy, I guess, who had possession of the gun said that he actually bought it on the street. And they believe, you know, that to be the case. You know, they have no reason to believe that he didn't buy it on the street. So hopefully sometime soon, the Cincinnati Police Department, the officers who found the gun, will be able to return that to Cheryl Bryant, Doug Bryant's widow. She's really happy about that. They're, of course, going to test the gun, test fire it, look at the shell casings, and make sure that it wasn't used in any crimes.
I mean, this was a man who was killed 17 years ago, and 9 years ago, his widow's home was burglarized, the gun was stolen, and it was just found in a traffic stop. And I mean, we don't exactly know how many times it's changed hands yet, right?
Right. And she said, and just to clarify, her home was burglarized back in 2011. There was another gun stolen at that time, but this gun was stolen in the second burglary.
Oh, my apologies. Gotcha.
Last November.
Okay, so it hasn't been gone that long.
Yeah, but she said that when she had talked to the police officers, they said, you know, it may eventually turn up, but it's probably going to change hands several times. It may take years for this to show up. So, and I interviewed the officer who actually found the gun, the detective, and really nice guy named Tracy Jones, and he was just really happy. They're working hard to get these guns off the street. And he was just really happy that he's able to find something that he hopefully will be able to return to a fallen officer's widow very soon.
And Jeanette, I think the last time that we had you on the show, it was in the good old days when you could come in the studio. And if I remember correctly, right. You brought your dog with you. And so I remember you as an animal lover. So you must have been delighted to be assigned to what we'll end with here, a happier story involving the Hamilton County Dog Warden.
Right. And just so you know, Michael, old habits die hard. So Bella is sitting on the couch right next to me as I'm leaning over my laptop talking to you.
Perfect. Hi, Bella. Well, what's going on with the dog warden?
So basically what happened was the SPCA of Greater Cincinnati, they went into the Hamilton County commissioners in the last year and a half or so and said, look, we don't want the dog warden contract anymore. And the SPCA had the dog warden contract for probably 50 years. So the commissioners, they are tasked by state statute with taking care of stray animals. And so they have to have a dog warden. there aren't a lot of organizations that do this type of thing. So they had to find somebody. Hamilton County Sheriff Jim Neal, who's going to be leaving office in January, he wanted the contract, but he didn't want to do the shelter part of it. He wanted to do the enforcement part of it, where you investigate animal cruelty and things like that. So the commissioners ultimately ended up taking a bid or accepting a bid from the Claremont Care Animal Humane Society. And that's a nonprofit and organization that's been taking care of the shelter out in Claremont County for the last couple of years. And they've been lauded for the things they've done out there. They have a no-kill philosophy. So they have a foster program, which helps keep the shelter population down. And they really do a lot to help find these animals. So they bid on the contract. They won the contract. They took over the shelter in Northside in the last month or so. It was August 1st, I believe. And they said that in their first month of operation, they were able to save 98% of the animals that came in. Just because they're no-kill, though, doesn't mean they don't euthanize animals. If they believe an animal's suffering or is a danger to the community, then it will be euthanized. But they said through sheltering through fostering and other things, they were able to save 98% of those animals. And they're really excited about it. They're a very passionate group. And they said the county's making improvements to that shelter. You may know if you've ever been there, it's very old, it's antiquated, and will likely need to be replaced. But they're really excited. And the volunteers there who used to be with the SPCA too think this has been a really positive change.
Well, that's good news. And I'm sure a story that Bella enjoyed watching as well.
Yeah, she's sitting here listening very attentively. And I forgot that I brought Bella in that one time. That's so funny.
And Jeanette Levy from WKRC TV Local 12. Thanks for coming on. And we will look for you bright and early on the weekend.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it, Michael.
Our pleasure. 200,000 square feet of a downtown Cincinnati building will be vacated when a large local employer makes a move soon. And the Enquirer's new food writer is with us. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Fifth Third Bank is moving a bunch of employees, well, at least when they return from remote work, out of one downtown tower and leaving a huge swath of vacant space. And the Bengals dropped their second game of the season also by one score. They're not just on the bottom of the division, though. They're also on the bottom in monetary value, according to Forbes. So let's talk about all that with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Steve Watkins. Steve, thanks for coming back on.
Sure. Glad to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure to have you. And so I'm a guy who lives in a 700 square foot studio apartment. So when I read something like 200,000 square feet, which is the amount of office space Fifth Third is vacating, is that as much as it feels like to a guy like me?
It's hard to get a grasp on that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, I'll tell you a good way to comprehend it, though, is it's basically six full floors of the 580 building, the AT 580 building at 580 Walnut Street downtown. It's right across Walnut from Fifth Third's headquarters. And if you think about what a typical entire floor of an office building is and take six of those, you can tell that's an awful lot of space. And it really is enough to even change a little bit the downtown office space market when all of a sudden you have that much space that's contiguous coming on the market.
Okay, so we're talking about 800 employees who work on those six floors. And I guess right. We should emphasize, it doesn't look like these folks are losing their jobs. They're being moved across the street.
That's right. In fact, they are definitely not losing their jobs. What Fifth Third's doing is basically they're cutting their office real estate. So that's real estate that does not include branches, but includes a lot of office space like this. They're cutting that by 20% across the company. The biggest chunk of what they have is in Cincinnati because Fifth Third is based in Cincinnati. 1.5 million square feet in total is local for Fifth Third out of 4.5 million that they have across the country in office space. So a third of their space is here. That means a big chunk of what's here is being cut. And Fifth Third remodeled their downtown headquarters on Fountain Square. They've been remodeling it over the last few years. And part of that remodeling enables them to fit more people in the space that they have, partly because they're going to this system. A lot of companies are going to where a lot of their workers don't have a specific office and a desk. Instead, they kind of share it because a lot of them aren't in the office at the same time.
Yeah, so those six floors at the AT580 building are pretty much empty right now anyway, except you probably got people's desks that are still in there. Did they give you any indication when they expect this large workforce to return to some sense of normalcy?
Well, there, it sounds like it'll be at least till the end of the year, at least for the people in the 580 building. They will be home working. And as you point out, a lot of these workers have been working at home anyway because of the coronavirus pandemic. The 580 building workers will be home at least through the end of the year. And then after that, it just depends. Fifth Third still has people working from home, as a lot of companies do because of the pandemic. So a lot of that is wait and see, but it sounds like around year end, they're going to kind of have another evaluation of that.
We're talking with Steve Watkins, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. And Steve, there's been a lot of talk since we've seen so many of our friends spend this pandemic, this quarantine working from home, that perhaps this is, you know, I guess this is now a cliche, the new normal for a lot of people. And I know you talked to someone from Colliers International about what does Fifth Third's move represent in a broader sense as it relates to old school office buildings?
Right. Well, that's what a lot of people, including people in the real estate world, are seeing and expecting is that companies are shifting away from needing as much office space as they had before. A lot of what they're seeing is a lot of their employees can work from home, be just as effective, and in many cases, even more effective and efficient when they're working at home. So that's a way for companies to save money on real estate, which is what Fifth Third's doing. And that's a lot of what's driving it. A lot of what the real estate people are thinking is that a lot of these companies are taking another look at what they're doing in terms of their office space. And with social distancing requirements and working from home, they're just kind of reevaluating everything. So look for more shifts like this.
And so with 800 employees moving out of one building for Fifth Third into their headquarters, again, we're emphasizing that these aren't people losing their jobs. In fact, you talked to a banking analyst who you say grows more bullish about that company.
Yeah. One of the things in the banking industry, bank stocks have really gotten hammered this year. Fifth Third is down close to 30% year to date. And you think of the stock market is doing poorly this year, but it's roughly about flat for the year. So by comparison, Fifth Third and most bank stocks have really gotten hammered. The reason is a lot of their loans to companies and consumers are viewed as being kind of at risk because obviously, a lot of companies have gotten hit hard by the economy during this time, so have consumers. And the risk is they're not going to be able to pay their loans back. But the analyst says the loan losses are probably not going to be as bad as a lot of people fear. And the other thing, probably even more strongly, is that banks, and Fifth Third has been among the leaders in this, have set aside a lot of money to cover potential loan losses. Fifth Third CEO Greg Carmichael told me about a month ago that feel like the hundreds of millions of dollars they've taken in loan loss reserves should set them up pretty well, and he doesn't expect them to have to take a lot more of these reserves to cover potential losses. And that's a good sign for Fifth Third, and that's what this analyst sees. He thinks the stock's going to go up.
Our guest now is Business Courier reporter Steve Watkins. And Steve, in addition to people working from home, a lot of people are learning from home, though local colleges and universities are taking different approaches to this. I know a lot of kids are back on campus. I think I'm old enough to call them kids now, even though they're college age. The Business Courier hosted some leaders, the presidents of local universities and colleges, to talk about what this pandemic has meant for them and what their future looks like. And perhaps that's not as certain as this banking analyst may have said about Fifth Third. What's the situation that you all learned at this event?
Yeah, we had our Future of Education virtual event yesterday, and it was really interesting. We had the leaders from four of the major universities locally, UC, Xavier, NKU, and Mount St. Joseph's. And they talked about what education, higher education, is going to look like, and what it looks like now in the time of coronavirus. And they pretty unanimously said they see it changing. Melissa Bauman, the provost of Xavier, said we will be changed and it will be forever. And there's no going back. So, but they all felt that way. Neville Pinto at UC talked about changes that he sees coming in the future in terms of not only how universities educate, but he talked about the importance of talent, human talent, and continuing education for adults being a lot bigger deal than it has been in the past. He also talked about a really interesting program UC has with Hughes High School to develop tech IT students there, and they actually take classes while they're in high school that kind of pave the way for them at UC, and they can get in to UC without standardized testing even when they're in this program. So there are a lot of things like that. Mount St. Joseph's president, James Williams, talked about the need to better serve low-income students to tap into more talent that might not typically have a chance to get to college. There are definitely changes. Xavier talked about they're going to have to reevaluate what it means to be a residential university in the future, partly because of things like the pandemic. So, yeah, a lot of trends that are developing and changing.
That's something that I was very curious about. And we see, all the campuses are building something, some more than others. And so what does that mean? Should they have built these things? I mean, obviously, they didn't know a pandemic was coming, but did they express any fear about campus expansions and whether that would be scaled back?
Yeah, it was interesting. They talked about capital projects. Ashish Vadaya from NKU, the president there, he said they have a residence hall that's under construction and they're going ahead with it. And, they are not hesitant at all about that, even though more students probably are learning online or definitely are learning online. They still have a need and will in the future for more housing there, as people who have attended NKU can certainly vouch for. But there were other projects at other universities, many that are going forward, athletic facilities and things like that. UC has numerous projects going on. But UC also has one project. I believe it's redeveloping the Lindner Business Center into a College of Law building that Neville Pinto said they're putting on hold for now. He didn't say it's being canceled or anything like that, but just temporarily because of budget issues and the coronavirus pandemic, they're kind of deciding to hold off on that for a little bit.
And one of the significant changes, of course, even though some students are returning to campus, that's not necessarily true for a typical number of international students, which all these universities, certainly UC, Xavier, NKU, enjoy having on their campuses. What did they have to say about that?
That really stood out during the discussion is a couple of them, Neville Pinto at UC, definitely mentioned the number of international students. I think if I remember right, UC has about 3,000, but about 800 of those right now are, as he put it, stranded overseas, many because of travel restrictions. They can't get back here. And there are issues like that there. Other universities saw the same thing. And so hopefully that all gets straightened out. They sounded like they felt like it would. It didn't sound like a long-term issue, and they felt like next semester, which would start after the first of the year, that they feel like they'll be able to get those students back in the fold. But Neville Pinto talked about how important it is to have those international students there.
And we're talking with Steve Watkins, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. Let's talk about sports, Steve. There's a big stadium being constructed right outside our studio. That hasn't slowed down at all during this pandemic. And that's where FC Cincinnati is going to play. And I guess I never really thought about it until I read this article that it doesn't really have a name. We just call it FC Cincinnati Stadium. And Jeff Birding is hoping to find someone's name to put on there. What's the latest with that?
They are definitely looking for a naming rights sponsor. They actually do call it West End Stadium for now, but that name, at least if FC Cincinnati has its way at all, will not remain for long, because that's just the name they've given it. And they certainly would rather have a company name to attach to that at a price. I talked to a couple of industry insiders who said deals like this in Major League Soccer typically bring about $3 million to $4 million a year. And the deals often run for 10 to 15 years. So that's a nice chunk of money that FC Cincinnati wants to haul in. And they're working on a naming rights sponsor. Stadium's due to open next spring when the MLS season starts, probably around the beginning of March. So they certainly want a deal before then. Jeff Birding, the team president, told me he's hoping and kind of shooting for wrapping it up by year end. But, you know, that remains to be seen.
And now let's talk about the Bengals. Two losses in 5 days to start the season, but everyone's still excited about Joe Burrow, it looks like. So they're on the bottom of the division right now at 0-2 after losing to Cleveland on Thursday. And they're also on the bottom of another rating that involves their value. Steve, can you tell us a little bit about what Forbes had to say about the value of the Cincinnati Bengals?
Sure. The Bengals actually are... Well, two things that are a little bit negative here. One is they are last in the NFL among the 32 teams in valuation. They're valued at $2 billion, which is still really, really good. So you have to hesitate a little bit when you talk about negatives. But in the world of the NFL, the Bengals are right at the bottom, $2 billion. The other thing is their valuation stayed exactly flat with the previous year. And overall in the NFL, team valuations rose by about 7% on average based on these Forbes valuations that they do every year. And these deals these estimates, I should say, are very highly respected, thought of as being very close to accurate. And the fact that the Bengals did not increase in value and remain at the bottom is not a great thing. On the plus side, the Brown family, Mike Brown, ultimately his dad, Paul Brown, who started the team, and his investors paid just $7.5 million in 1967. So their investment is worth 267 times what it was then. So don't feel too bad for the Brown family.
I don't think anyone does, Steve, but we'll take your advice anyway. Steve Watkins is a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. Thanks for spending part of your Friday with us, Steve. We appreciate it very much.
Glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Keith Pandolfi is back in Cincinnati after moving away nearly two decades ago. The prolific food writer's work has appeared in Savour, Serious Eats, and even the Wall Street Journal, among others. And now his words will appear in the Cincinnati Inquirer, where he is now the staff food writer. And Keith Pandolfi joins us now via Zoom. Keith, thanks for spending 5 minutes with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's an honor to be here.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm a big fan of food, as it turns out, and you've got a pretty cool task ahead. You've written a lot about food over the years for a variety of publications in a variety of places, and you write about Cincinnati in your introductory column to readers of the Inquirer. Yes, I knew the city was up and coming. I just didn't know how far it had come. What do you mean by that?
I think when I moved back here, I was just overwhelmed by the number of restaurants that had just opened, not just in Over the Rhine, but over in your neck of the woods in Northern Kentucky. Covington is just exploding right now. There's just so many little secret restaurants outside of the city that I never knew about. People are like, I can't believe you haven't been to this place or that place. The chef community here is just so strong, and I was overwhelmed, and this is coming from New York. I still feel overwhelmed by the number of restaurants that are out there.
And so what do you do to get your head around it all, right? Because not only are you covering food in a city that is seeing its food opportunities expand so rapidly in just about every corner of this metro area, there's also this pandemic thing going on, and that's an industry that's been hit particularly hard.
Yeah, it's a weird time to be a food writer. And as you'll notice, but my title is food and dining writer, not food critic. Because right now, given what every restaurant owners and restaurant workers are going through, the last thing I want to do is criticize. I don't want to deflate anyone right now. my job right now is to bring attention to the number of wonderful restaurants and the number of wonderful efforts restaurant owners are making right now to bring people in, to keep their crowds coming in. It's a tough time, but I really want to be optimistic in my coverage of the industry here. I don't want it all to be a downer. I know there's a lot of restaurants aren't going to make it through this, and I want to do my best to help them out right now.
What are you hearing from the industry here locally? Because we know their indoor capacity is significantly reduced, and outdoor dining has been nice, but you know, Cincinnati doesn't have the nicest of winters, and so that opportunity is probably going away soon. So are there heightened concerns?
Yes. Everyone I've talked to is still trying to figure it out. They're looking at tent situations, heat lamps, but some places have large parking lots that they can put those tents in, some don't. So there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen in the winter. And I'm very concerned about, you know, how they're going to handle that.
I think a lot of us are. I do want to note that we talked to your predecessor, Polly Campbell, before before she departed. So she was a guest on our program, and that was a great conversation. And you referenced her in your introductory column. You wrote, quote, "I'm your new food and dining writer, not your new Polly Campbell, mind you, because Polly is Polly, because Polly is forever. But as a writer, I hope I can make the same kind of inroads Polly once did into your hearts and, of course, your stomachs, even if that might take a little while." So let's spend our last 90 seconds or so together, Keith, and just give us your general philosophy about what this role means and how you'll approach it.
It's a big role. I mean, even though I've written for a lot of national publications, this is probably the most intimidating job I've ever had, because I'm writing for this city about food that they probably know better than I do right now. Polly had a real connection to the community, and people really trusted her. And my goal is just for people to, over time, have the same trust in me, and to know that I am approachable, that I am not, I'm the least pretentious food writer you're ever going to meet. I love chain restaurants as much as I do white tablecloth restaurants. But you know, I miss Polly already. I miss reading Polly. I was reading her a lot in New York, and I know that I've got some, as I said, big shoes to fill. I'm thinking about wearing a hat just to honor.
I was going to ask if you were going to wear a hat, because that was certainly a trademark for her right up until the end. So very, very cool. Keith, we're going to look forward to your writing. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Welcome back home. And I hope you'll come back on when we can talk more about the industry and its situation with the pandemic, but also when there's some interesting general food stuff to talk about. I don't think anyone gets tired of talking about what to eat.
Great. And I'd love to come back. Thanks for the offer.
Awesome. Keith Pandolfi is with the Cincinnati Inquirer, the new food and dining writer. Keith, thanks again.
Thank you.
And listeners, we've made it to Friday. Well done. Thanks for spending part of it with us here at Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. The composer of this theme song is Rob Vetters. And you can find archives of our program every episode online at wvxu.org. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday to talk to you then. I'm Michael Monks.